Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today we're going back, or maybe just back to the future. Let me explain. Our guest is Rick Tellender. He's a writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, and while he might object to what I'm about to say, he's basically a legendary sports writer. He wrote the classic book on street basketball, Heaven is a Playground. He's written dozens of first-rate feature stories. He's someone I've looked up to in my own career. 23 years ago, he published a book titled The 100-Yard Lie, The Corruption of College Football and What We Can Do to Stop It. Now, at the time, Rick was covering the sport for Sports Illustrated. So he was writing about the problems that he saw. But as it turns out, almost everything he saw then are the same problems we see now. Amateurism, commercialism, academic fraud, hypocrisy, violence, and of course the NCAA's general uselessness. It's pretty much all there. And given that we've just finished another college football season, I thought it'd be illuminating to bring Rick on to talk about what's changed and what hasn't. So Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always wanted to have you on. And really want to talk about this book for so long, because even when I was a really young sports writer just starting out, you know, I picked this book up and it actually, I would say it radicalized me. It definitely helped change and shape my view of the sport. But I want to go back in time with you to the moment you started working on this book. You describe it at the beginning of the book that you're there talking to your editor at Sports Illustrated about college football, and a phrase keeps popping up in your head: child abuse. The idea that these college football players are actually kids, kind of like your own kids, and they're being taught lessons that you don't believe in, and as you write, receiving pain that does not need to be received. You also write that myths are being perpetuated in the sport, that lies were being told, and that all of it was coming at a tremendous psychic and societal cost. That something about college football was just so wrong and rotten from the foundation up. Now, all that is a really sweeping indictment, but I'm wondering, looking back now, what do you remember about how you got to the point of having those thoughts and feelings?
It was a long, slow process that actually began when I was a kid, I guess. It began certainly when I was in high school, and I began getting recruited to play football in college, not by any huge schools, but the process was there, and I got to see a little bit of it. I got to, you know, get visited by coaches who had different ideas about why they wanted me in college as opposed to what I thought college was about. I think sports are one of the greatest things. Well, I think they might be the greatest thing ever invented. I think when I wrote Heaven is a Playground, I really meant that. There's a phrase from G.K. Chesterton that I actually took that from, and it's life is a task garden, earth is a task garden, heaven is a playground. And it continues on to say that the real goal of life might be play. And I think there's some real truth to that, because play is what people do when they have the freedom to do it, when things are secure, when things are safe, when other things have been taken care of. And you don't see kids playing much in war-torn nations, and when they're in poverty, when they're starving. Those aren't the things that are conducive to play. So play has a very high place in the hierarchy of things that I cherish, maybe number one. And then you see all of a sudden that it's really, at certain levels, as I already knew, I guess intrinsically, it's about entertainment. And if it's about entertainment, and it's also about beating somebody else, which, of course, I love competitiveness, too. I don't think this thing where everybody wins is great either. But when those things come together, and there are men whose lives depend on you as a youth beating somebody else, well, then all sorts of things are going to be perverted. I think it's just the human nature. That's just the way it will be. And what it turns out is there's really nobody looking out for the young person. And you can say, well, the young person is doing it of his own free will. But we know that's not logical, and that's not the case, because young people's brains develop differently, and we have all kinds of laws and rules preventing kids from doing things at certain ages because we know they're not capable of it, such as driving. You know, a 14-year-old can say, hey, I can drive a car. And you might say, yeah, you can, but your brain isn't formed enough to make rational decisions about driving this thing that could kill people. And I think then when I became a sports writer, which I'd always wanted to be a writer somehow, deep inside. I never told anybody, but I wanted to. And I started covering college football then after having played at Northwestern for 4 years. I started to see things that I just couldn't take week after week after week. It really became kind of a distressful situation. I mean, truly, hard for me to do my work. I was going to campuses and watching teams that were great, and there were players on those teams that were, they had been bailed out of jail to play. They weren't taking classes. I remember Deion Sanders. I was going to Florida State, and Deion Sanders is in the locker room. He's got on a giant chain with diamonds and stuff on it, a big dollar sign in the middle of it, and it was almost refreshing. And the guy was like 19 years old, maybe 20 years old. He, in his certain way, understood what this was all about. So one of the editors at Sports Illustrated finally said to me, I think it was an editor there, and this was years after I wrote Heaven is a Playground, and they said, Rick, here's the fundamental problem. Don't ever see how the sausage is made. Right. And, you know, I saw how it was made. I was in the factory, and I followed the sheep and the pigs and the goats from the field all the way through the grinder, and it just became a little too much.
Really?
And again, as I said, I think there are solutions. My solution might not be perfect that I had at the end of the book, but at least it acknowledges things that are hypocritical. You can't get anywhere if things are hypocritical. You can get nowhere.
Well, I want to get to those solutions, but before we get there, and the hypocrisy as well, but before we get to those two things, I want to ask you about something else from the very beginning of the book, because the book to me, again, I really recommend people go out and read it. It's a very moral book, and you seem to be coming from a place of someone who truly cares and wants things to be better, and is, I guess, almost viscerally disgusted and upset by, again, the sausage making that you're seeing. And I'm going to kind of read you a quote from the book, which to me sort of summarizes it's almost like your 95 theses here. It's almost like your boiled down list of complaints. These are the things that seem to bother you. And I quote, the criminal behavior, the rampant pursuit of money, the tunnel vision of the coaches, the complacency of the fans, the sliminess of the boosters, the sanctimonious platitudes of the NCAA brass, the exploitations of the players, the desire to expand the season, to televise anything, to make money, 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 the brutality and the taunting on the field itself, the absurdity of the student-athlete notion, the lack of anything remotely like an ethical anchor. All of that filled me with disgust. And the ugliest part of it all was that these sins were being committed in a world that we have always assumed to be a realm of virtue and idealism. If colleges aren't pure in America, and if the things that take place in their classrooms and dorms and stadiums aren't good, then what can we have faith in? I mean, to me, that is the opposite of a cynical, hard-bitten sports writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I think you're right, Patrick. I think you can't feel that, what I felt at that moment and still feel. I felt it very intensely then, unless you really cared about something. You don't hate a person unless you really love that person, or that person truly betrayed some confidence or idealism you may have had. You know, like you said, you read this a while ago, and it sort of radicalized you. I hope it didn't turn you into a, you know, I hope you would have gotten there on your own, and I know you would have, because you're such a thoughtful, careful writer and thinker about these issues. But it's just, at some point, I see what this could be, and I see what it is not, and that is just very, very hurtful. And each one of those items that you ticked off there, I think each one can be addressed in certain ways, but they can't be addressed unless we acknowledge that they're problems. If you don't think it's a problem, you know, year after year after year, if you don't think it's a problem that coaches make up to $6 million a year, and that they get bonuses for every extra game they win, and that back in the day, teams played only 10 games and one extra game for a bowl game, and very few teams went to bowl games, and now everybody plays at least 13 games, some play 14, and when these playoffs come around, it might even be as many as 16 games, 15, 16, which was considered at one point way too much even for the NFL to play. Mm-hmm. They used to have 12 and then 14 game seasons. So it's not about these players any longer. I mean, the sport is wonderful to watch. TV has made it just spectacular. The slow motion, everything about it, and it's a great way for people to go back to their university that they've bonded with during a critical time in their lives when they were young and things meant a whole lot to them, and they partied and they met new people. They might have met their wife or their husband or their pals forever, their business partners. They took some classes that just, you know, were like light bulbs that changed their whole lives, and they see this all reflected in the football team. And I understand that. I understand that completely. But in the pursuit of excellence, when you have a football team aligned with a university, they actually have nothing to do with each other. Nothing. I always say, well, you know, Albert Einstein, nobody expected him to run a 4.3 40.
Right.
It was fine that he was just smart.
Right.
So you want a guy who runs a 4.3 40, why should you expect him to actually be getting an education while he's doing this? You know, coaches don't like it. I guarantee you this. They don't like it when players take really difficult courses and they get really good grades, because that means, and it means rationally and truthfully, that they're not spending as much time on football as they should.
And maybe they don't need football as much as other players do, too. They've got
other
options.
Yeah, and then the coaches see that player as kind of co-opting, you know, a spot on the team. I saw when I was in college, you know, that some of those players were just there. Once they got a scholarship, they just kicked back. And the coaches despised them, which in a way is understandable because those guys are like employees. They're not student athletes, that horrible phrase that the NCAA concocted. They're, you know, they're just guys on the football team, and some of them didn't care, and some of them weren't that good, but that's not their fault. And then some care desperately, and some get dreadfully injured. It's just a lot of things go on that, you know, that we just don't see on game day.
Well, you mentioned that horrible phrase, student athlete, and, you know, listeners of this podcast will know why I always use the term college athletes, and they'll know the history of student athlete being a concoction by the NCAA in order to avoid workers' comp. In your book, you call it an absurdity. I'm wondering, back in 1989, you know, well before Taylor Branch on the cover of the Atlantic, well before sort of the growing groundswell we see right now, bucking against the college sports economic system as we know it, when you were saying, hey, this is absurd, was that a kind of radical position to take, at least sort of culturally,
oh, yeah,
as a sports writer?
No, I was I was ridiculed and ostracized, and probably, I mean, not physically, but I know Bo Schembechler at Michigan went back and somebody asked him what he thought about the book, and he said, I don't remember game planning for Tellender. I mean, you know, and somebody, some
what a football coach answer that is.
Yeah, I mean, so that's like, that was how he would undermine my credibility.
Right.
But some reader went back and said, you know, I checked this out. Guess what? During Tellender's junior and senior year, when he started at defensive back, Northwestern didn't play Michigan. So, of course, they didn't game plan for him.
Right.
But anyway, no, there. I know there was one really influential sports writer, and the book publisher asked him for a quote about that, and his exact line was, get that thing away from me.
Wow.
It was, you know, people who love college football didn't want to see it, didn't want to hear about it. Probably the person who understood it the most, believe it or not, was George Will, who's a libertarian, you know, more as much as he's a conservative, and he understood intrinsically the economic aspect of this, because it, while it's maybe a radical approach, it's neither conservative nor really deeply liberal. It's rational, and you cannot call a pig a donkey. I mean, you just can't do it. You can, for as long as you want to, you can dress it up. And he understood that the entire notion of amateurism, that really has no meaning. It's incomprehensible. And you have to remember, at that time in 1989, when this came out, the Berlin Wall was just about ready to fall.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this before that happened. There was still the evil empire. There was still the Soviet Union, and the Olympics were in the process of becoming open to everybody, so, because they could not define amateurism. What, you know, what is a Soviet army captain who's on a basketball team? Is he a professional? Well, you're damn right he is, but by these weird rules, he's an amateur.
Right.
So, anyway, now it's open to everybody.
And the Olympics have never been more popular, which is one of the great arguments against college sports clinging to this. I mean, sometimes they will say, oh, well, if we, you know, and they've actually semi-argued this in court, although they've never had to prove it. The NCAA will say, well, amateurism is essential to the survival of our product. It's what makes us popular. And like I said, I think every league that's ever struggled did not adopt amateurism as a way to increase its viewership. So there's not any real world proof of this, but they kind of stick to it. But one of my favorite things that you go through in the book with regards to amateurism, I mean, you pretty much blow up the myth that it has any sort of moral basis whatsoever. That's not about purity or goodness or ancient Greek ideals. That not only that is it's basically un-American, that it comes from these snotty Victorian era English aristocrats who didn't want to have to row against unwashed factory workers. And then, even better, you make this great analogy. I'm going to quote it. You say, if you asked a neighborhood kid to come to your house and rake your leaves, would you have the gall at the end of the day to say, thanks a lot, son. Hope the raking was a good experience for you. I'd love to pay you, but you're an amateur.
But that little kid is Rick Tellender, age 12, in Peoria, Illinois. And if somebody had said to me, I'm standing there looking at the ground shyly, after mowing the grass, whatever, and they said, that's really nice, Rick. Go home and, go see your mommy. I would have probably cried all the way home. But they'd give me $5, or they'd some old geezer would really overtip me, give me $10. And it's like, yeah, that's right. This is American. This is how it works. This is work. We pay people for work, even if it's joyful work. You pay singers and entertainers who would love, they want nothing more than to sing and entertain. They still doesn't charge. It doesn't stop anybody from charging as much as they want. I would guess that like there's a whole heck of a lot of bands out there that would play virtually for free. And in New York, sometimes bands actually pay the clubs to let them play at the clubs. But getting money is like a wonderful reward, and it went all the way back to ancient Greece. This nonsense about amateurism being virtuous. That's one adjective I didn't use, Patrick, and I wish I had. Snotty. That's why I laughed. Snotty British in the 1800s.
We fought a revolutionary war to get away from that. That was the last thing we're supposed to want in America.
Right. God bless the Tea Party.
Tea Party should really get behind the anti-amateurism movement. I've always wondered why they don't, which is probably a whole other podcast. But one other thing, I'm wondering, when you look back at the time you wrote that then, and like you said, it was kind of a radical notion, and you look at where we've come now, we're not only in the courts do we have the whole Ed O'Bannon case, but honestly, I think in the court of public opinion, there has been a radical change in how the public views this. And I'm not saying the majority of people necessarily think that things need to be changed or they're going to go out on the streets to have it happen, but I think more and more people find this basic college sports economic system to be unfair. It's on the cover of Time magazine. More and more sports writers, the same sports writers who were criticizing you back in the day, are now on the side of that. More and more non-sports writers are on the side of that. It just seems like the cultural tide is shifting. Does that surprise you that this is finally happening, the ice is thawing?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, there has to be proper timing for everything. Nothing happens in life when we want it to, and one of the problems for idealists is that they never get to see things acted on as quickly as they think they should be. And, in this case, I'd throw myself in there as an idealist, but I knew it would take time if it ever happened. I think what people are waiting for now is someone to actually come up with a model, and they're waiting for a leader. Not a bomb thrower, but somebody who, I think a lot about Nelson Mandela, not to draw the direct parallel. But this man, the reason we salute him now is because of the things he did so long ago. He could have caused violent revolution in Africa. He could have created all kinds of mayhem, spent so many years in prison, a horrible cell that he stayed in, and he kept his faith because he knew what he was doing was right and the logic of it was correct. And so if there was somebody like that at the NCAA or a president or anybody, I think of Jim Delaney here, who's the commissioner of the Big Ten. Well, Jim Delaney started out as a enforcement guy from the NCAA. He's a lawyer, and then he comes in, and he's just old guard. We are not changing anything. But here's what he's great at, making money, and he has made billions for the Big Ten. And they went out, the Big Ten, talk about ludicrous, and I don't even know what you call it, Jabberwocky, Alice in Wonderland stuff. The Big Ten is soon to have 14 teams.
Right.
They'll still probably call it the Big Ten because it's They had 11 with Penn State, and they call it the Big Ten. Then they had 12 with Nebraska. They call it the Big Ten. And Maryland and Rutgers are coming in. So why not call it? You know, it's just like straight out of Orwell. Call it the Big Ten.
War is peace.
Try to figure it out. You say, no, Johnny, this is real math. 7 plus 7 equals 10.
Right.
Say, okay, I'll buy that. But Delaney would be a perfect person. Instead of making all this TV revenue, the Big Ten Network, bringing in tons and tons of money for the coaches, for the athletic departments, for himself. He makes over $3 million a year. How about being a guy who says, you know what? Let's change the system. Let's let the players, they play in these bowl games, let's set up annuities for them down the road. Let's guarantee they get educations no matter how long it takes. They're on scholarship. Let's think about a new model instead of being dragged into it, kicking and screaming the way every institution
by
seems
the courts,
to.
Essentially.
The courts, case, and it will be, you're absolutely right, Pat. It has to be the courts, and it will be insurance, which is also a type of legal thing,
right?
Because it's not going to come from the ethics of these men.
No, and you know, I'm glad you used the word ethics, because one of the things that's great in the book is I think you actually diagnose, you know, we all talk about how this system is kind of economically unfair, but you actually diagnose another, I think, very serious problem with amateurism, which is the hypocrisy of it, but what that hypocrisy does to the very college athletes we're talking about. You know, when you have one group of people, and it's a single group of people, the athletes, that's being told, like you said earlier, making money for your valuable skills is morally wrong. And then you have a second group of people, which is literally everyone else in society, making money off their skills and making money off the skills of those same athletes, and turning around telling those athletes it's wrong for you to do the same. There's something very corrosive that happens there, I think, especially when you're dealing with young people that are in, you know, what is ostensibly supposed to be an educational environment. There's this great quote in the book, I think, from a professor of sports psychology, a guy named Thomas Tulco. He was at San Jose State University at the time. He told you, I quote, "You can't blame the athlete when he sees the whole world cheating. That seems to be the ethos in our society today. Can I get away with it is the question. Athletes don't feel they're doing anything wrong." If you're a college football player then, and if you're one now, looking at amateurism and hypocrisy and what's going on in the sport and even in society, is all of what Tulco said more true than ever?
Yes, absolutely. Think about people who become stars in the NFL once the corruption, the hypocrisy is, you know, the veil is pierced, so to speak, and you're a pro, and everything goes. We have a guy, Cam Newton, watched him play yesterday. You know, he's considered a great guy. Completely, when he was at Auburn, you know, he's trying to get money, and mm-hmm. coaches there, Gene Chizik and others, were making millions of dollars. Go to Ohio State just before that, Terrell Pryor, the great quarterback for Ohio State, that helped into these terrific seasons. You know, that became this tattoo gate where players are giving away trinkets, trading trinkets that they'd be given by the school. And I thought it's almost like wampum given to, Native Americans when the settlers first came here for tattoos. And that was considered illegal. And I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. It is far more true now as the coaches make. When I was playing back in the day, coaches were middle-class citizens, even like Woody Hayes mm-hmm. at Ohio State. They weren't wealthy. Now these guys are the new emperors. They're nouveau riche. They have private jets. They have bonuses that kick in that are just incredible. They get bonuses for what their own players do. And so the players are sitting there thinking, you know, I wasn't allowed to take this major because we practice at this time. We play 14 games. We can't leave in the summer. Here's the greatest hypocrisy. You say to somebody, well, we can't, to somebody in the authority, and they'll say, we can't pay these players because they're amateurs. And then I'll just say to them, well, you know, you should give them something. And they say, well, we do. We give them a free scholarship. And then you just say to them, well, the scholarship is very valuable. You say, you're damn right it's valuable. It's very valuable. And I said, so it's worth money. Yeah, it's worth money. Well, then you've already acknowledged you're paying them. It's just the coin you're paying them in.
Right.
And it's a very cheap, very devious coin because they might not ever be able to cash it. trying to study when you're getting ready to play Ohio State, or you're getting ready to play Southern Cal, or you're getting ready to play Alabama, is about impossible. Because what you do on that Saturday in front of millions of people on TV is a little bit more important than how you do in that midterm. And if you could come back and study when you actually had your wits about you, it'd be great. But I think the players do see this. They just figure out, how can I get mine? Because I don't see any ethical standards here whatsoever. None. And they really find this out when they get injured badly and they're of no value to the team. Time and again, I hear from college players who badly injured with a knee or back injury, hip injury, something that really prevents them from ever playing well again. They'll say, you know what? It really got to me. A coach didn't even come and visit me in the hospital. Or once I came back and was rehabbing, it was like I didn't exist. And you hear that again and again and again. And the reason is you have no value to the coach. So this all processes in your brain, and I don't think you come out of there with good ethical, moral compass at all after playing college sports. Not at all. I'd be very leery of hiring a high-level collegiate football player if I were in a some kind of business that mandated ethics. I think a lot of football players would be perfect for Wall Street.
I was about to say, is it any coincidence that the financial industry and Wall Street loves hiring former college athletes, given what we're talking about?
Not at all. Not at all. They will take advantage of things. You know, and in a sense, that is part of America, too. But we also, mm-hmm. as we become more and more civilized, we try to get away from this Wild West, I'll take whatever I can, you know, by hook or by crook. I'll fleece anybody else. I'll play right up to the edge of the rules and beyond as long as I don't get caught. We try to overcome that with the kind of more modern sense of what it means to be a good, decent human being. You know, without being overly idealistic, but this could be done. That's the thing. This is not impossible to change, and it will not ruin college sports. And this kind of morality they found can be taught. Mm-hmm. A lot of there was a study done a while back, and these players were asked simple questions like, what is sportsmanship? And they would answer things like, it's winning the game whenever you can. It's being better than the other player. They had no idea what actual sportsmanship means. Now, those are things that can be taught. Just like, you know, and I think in elite business classes in our universities, there's an ethics mm-hmm. class that is taught. There are ethics classes that need to be taught because it's something that people can pervert, particularly coaches, whose real goal is not to educate, it's not to do anything. It shouldn't be. It's to win games. So let's just acknowledge that. Your coach doesn't give a damn whether you graduate or not.
Well,
it's nice if you do.
You know, it's funny because in the book, you actually say the whole idea that college football builds character, which is kind of the one of the foundational myths of having sports attached to our schools in the first place. You write that this idea of the big time football coach as a teacher of young men is a fraud, and you talk about how these notions about trying hard and self sacrifice and working towards a common goal with your teammates are nice concepts, but in this I want to quote you: much of the football rhetoric doled out by coaches is nothing but third rate psychological pap, sprinkle of cliches that have only the slightest basis in everyday life, slogans that are useful in football. Never surrender, most aggressive player wins, intimidation earns respect, can be downright harmful in normal society, where restraint, compromise, and cooperations are more typical ways of moving forward in the daily game. Now, I agree with that, but one thing that I think may have changed in our society since 1989, when the book came out, is that I think maybe in the non-sports part of our society, we've become more individualized and more competitive and maybe even more cutthroat. And I say this because we kind of have a two Americas economy now, and we've gotten rid of a lot of the social safety net. And I think our basic attitudes, and again, I say this as someone who was all of 14 years old or 13 years old in 1989, it seems to me that our basic attitudes are much more market oriented. You know, I got mine, you get yours.
Yep.
And if you don't, it's your fault and your place to suffer. So I want to ask you a tricky question, which is, your criticism of how football doesn't prepare people for society, does it now actually prepare them better character-wise than it did 20 years ago?
I find that fascinating that you picked up on that thing, because that's exactly something that has occurred to me as the world becomes more devious, well, then, you know, being involved in a devious major, if you will, in college, yeah, that might benefit you. And I would say here's two major things that have changed. The global economy has changed, made countries more cutthroat, corporations far more cutthroat since they cut across, national lines. There's really, if you work for Shell Oil, you don't work for a company in the United States. You know, you work for this almost a nation unto itself. And then the second thing is the internet has changed everything. When I wrote this, there were no, there was none of that. There was the internet. I don't know what it was in 1989. Most of the research for this came about through the 80s. So the ability to, I tell people the biggest factor back then was you had to face somebody. You had to call somebody on the phone. You had to go to the library. If there was a group of people together, people were not texting or looking anywhere else. They were confronting each other. There was no other way to do it unless you held up a book right in front of somebody's face. So I think we still haven't comprehended the full impact of the individuality that comes from the internet, from cell phones, from technology. It's brought people together, but it's separated people too in a way that a lot of people are more comfortable texting or messaging somebody that they really don't want to speak to in person. Yeah, it's very odd. You know, you can do entire business deals without ever meeting anybody or talking to them. So I think that, in a way, has led to more of this individualism, and the collapse of the industrial society here in the United States has left. I mean, there's no middle class, as far as I can see. If you're in the middle class, you're one couple of bad months away from being lower class or in poverty. It's the safety nets have gone. Society has really changed a huge amount. So, I mean, if you want to say that college football prepares you to be a cutthroat, nasty capitalist, I guess you could say, yeah, maybe it does. But, if that's the case, then it better come with a warning, and you also better be able to get yours while you're doing it. You better be, if you're Johnny Manziel, you better be able to go to your coach and say, Time Magazine just said I'm worth, whatever, $1.2 million a year to this school. I want that. I'll take that any way you want to pay me, but pay it to me. And don't give me this nonsense about me being 20 years old and too young to handle it. That's my problem. You don't tell that to boy bands or, Justin Bieber or tennis players or anybody else. Let's do it. This, I know what I'm worth. This is the free market. If you want to handle it that way, let's do it.
Well,
but don't tell me I'm, just an amateur little kid who should be enjoying collegiate life. If I want to do that, I will. I could pay my way to school. You pay me what I'm worth. And, the complaints that coaches and athletic directors and presidents and the NCAA have, which is this, we can't pay them. It'll create chaos. What will we do about insurance? What will we do about Social Security, about workman's comp? And the answer is, well, I don't know. I don't know what you'll do, but just start and it'll work out.
How about do the same thing you do for everybody else that works at the university? I think you've already figured it out. That's actually my response is like, I'm pretty sure you have an HR department. Why don't you get them on it? You mentioned how the sport should come with a warning. I almost wonder if the sport sometimes should now come with a warning label, just like the ones we see on the back of football helmets. And obviously this gets into the problem of violence, which is, and physical harm, not a new problem in football, obviously. It's been there from the start, and especially in college football. But obviously, as well, the issue of concussions and brain damage has become much bigger than it was in 1989. I don't even know if there's that much of a mention in your book, because I don't know how much awareness there was or understanding there was medically, scientifically, culturally about this.
Well, that's a good point, Patrick. But before I forget, I mean, you continue on, but I felt it intrinsically. I mean, that there had to be brain damage going on, but there were no studies per se that I knew of at that time.
Well, I'm curious, you have this great line in the book where you say, the only way normal students get hurt as badly as football players is in car wrecks. And, obviously what we've learned about concussions, that's doubly true. If you were riding the 100-yard line now instead of then, how much do you think you would have focused on that part of the equation, and what would your feelings have been about it? Or what are your feelings about it?
Well, my feelings are very strong about it. They certainly, that would have been part of it. I think it's been covered so well we've been writing about it. And, you know, Mark Fainaru-Wada and his mm-hmm. brother Stephen Fainaru had their book, was League of Denial.
Yep.
You know, and those are, I mean, those are my buddies. I've known Mark forever. He went to Northwestern. And, you know, I knew that there'd be guys like that that are just laying this all out there. And there have been other people working on it for so long. You know, I went to Boston University and talked to Dr. Ann McKee. I was in her lab looking at the brains that she had there.
Yeah, it's powerful to go there, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was back, I want to say maybe 4 years ago, mm-hmm. 3-4 years ago. But I certainly would have that in there, and I don't think we know all the facts. We certainly don't know all the facts, but it should come with a complete warning. And I tell you, my son just graduated from college, and he played Division I lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about this last night, and he just turned 23. And he said, you know, Dad, if I have kids, I'm not going to let them play football. And he himself was a very good football player who tore his knee up just before his senior season, so he never got to play. He was a wide receiver. And Tommy Reese, the quarterback for Notre Dame, was the quarterback in his mm-hmm. high school. And he used to throw every pass to Zach, you know, so it was going to be a really good season. But I already had doubts. I was concerned, and he had received a concussion back when he was a sophomore, and it scared the living daylights out of me. And, you know, Dave Duerson lived right around here, and I knew Dave, and, you know, all this, you know, when he committed suicide, all this, it was just, there's this pall over a game that we knew was damaging, but as you get the facts, you have to consider that. You really have to consider that as should it even be played. And certainly, I don't think there's any reason to play it before age 14.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, it's still, there's something about it that's it's wonderful, and it will, as I say in the book, little kids will start to play, little boys. I watch them sometimes on fields. They'll start to play something, mm-hmm. run around, it gets rougher and rougher, and pretty soon they're playing something very much like football. It's something we just like to do, but between the helmets and the practices, the subconcussive hits, the physical damage that can be just done by the size and speed of players. You know, way back in the day, the average player was like 5'10", 170 would be a normal size for a player, almost at any position. And a 6-foot, 200-pound guy was considered big. I mean, we're going way back. I remember talking with Jay Berwanger, the Heisman Trophy winner, and he was like 5'10", 165 or something. He said, everybody was about my size. Well, when you have 350-pounders or even more frightening, guys who weigh 260 who can run 4.5 40s, you've got a whole different ball of wax right there in front of you.
Well, there's a lot more, obviously, just from, you know, force equals mass times acceleration, there's a lot more potential for delivering and receiving force in the game, which is going to lead to, I would assume, a bigger and more damaging injuries. Glad you brought up the literal physical size differences in players, because even compared to when you were riding 100-yard line and now, there's still a big jump. I mean, you write about, and it was honestly a very troubling but also a very funny section about Tony Mandarich, the old SI cover boy, NFL draft bust, the incredible bulk, who was this huge, dominant college offensive lineman, totally juiced out of his mind, as we found out later. And at the time, it was like, this guy is Zeus among us. You know, he is an Easter Island statue walking the earth. But now he would be like an average-sized offensive tackle. So
yes.
I have to ask you, not obviously like you mentioned before, the size and the speed have increased and maybe they are more dangerous, but does that sort of suggest that steroid use is also a lot more common in college football?
Well, it was so common back in the 1980s that if you didn't take it and you were a lineman or whatever, it was unusual at the big schools. And one of the people who sparked a lot of this was this guy, Tommy Chaikin, who was a lineman at South Carolina. And
mm-hmm.
he eventually went public with his steroid use. They took everything. It was almost as if they were in a veterinarian lab. These guys would have shooting parties at South Carolina, and they would just shoot each other up with this and that, from Winstrol and Decadurablin and things that were meant for, equine reasons, for horses and everything that they could. And they just started bench pressing and lifting and becoming just nuts. He talked about roid rage, how it was absolutely real for him, getting in, getting stabbed in a bar fight, just on and on and on. And then that case eventually, there were so many players that were using steroids in South Carolina that, and they were no different from most other big programs, as best you can tell anecdotally, that one of those coaches ended up getting going to prison or being, I can't remember the exact case. He came back to the coaching ranks, but at any rate, he ended up going to jail, and there was a whole big steroid thing, and then it just kind of died down and disappeared. But there's something about this size thing. I think it has to do maybe with size generally everywhere. I mean, my son is much bigger than I am. I don't know why, but they lift weights forever, and I guarantee you he hasn't been on steroids, or he better not have. We've talked about it since he was a little kid. And we just talk about it as being ethically just wrong, and the things that it can do to you. And I've dealt with bodybuilders who have just destroyed themselves, their livers, their hearts, their vascular system, their kidneys. They get tumors, all these things, die of heart attacks. Pro wrestlers die in their 40s, it seems like, constantly. But along with that, we've selected for huge people. And I kind of predicted, I think I predicted in the 100-yard line that we would have 350 and 400-pound linemen. We're getting close to that, very close. I mean, there are 350-pound guys. But I remember asking...
Oh, we're getting close to that in Texas high school football. Your prediction was right on.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not hard if you sit there and just put your little thinking cap on and look to the future. People aren't getting smaller. They never have. So one question would be, should there be weight limits? Could they change the rules? One way to do it to get rid of these monstrosities, if we wanted to, would be, say, players have to play both ways. I mean, these guys couldn't do it.
Right.
But, again, we're never going back that way. We like the fact there's headsets, there's communications from the press box. We like all the technology, and we like the guys playing. They're not even just playing one way. They're playing maybe just on third downs.
Well, and also, if you're serious about trying to reduce the number of hits to the head, the last thing you want is guys going in and playing offensive and defensive line or something like that. So,
I mean, there's something that needs to be done about the helmet. There's so many things, and I think the time is right. It has been for years for somebody to stop protecting the status quo, particularly in college football. I think the NFL will become marginalized like pro boxing is. It'll be for the underclass and people with nothing left to lose, or, you know, just that'll be how it'll be. But college sports are still tied in with our universities, and that's where we need a reformer. There's somebody that people can say, hey, this guy makes sense, or this woman makes sense, or they're not strident, they're not, I don't know what they are, but if it could be done, it would have to be done at the top level. They would say, this is wrong. Our coach is making all of this money. Well, there are hundreds making over $1 million a year.
Well, speaking of, we were just talking about player growth and then the need for reform and potentially size limits. Well, like, what about athletic departments? You want to talk about growth. Again, a great line in the book, one I'm going to steal for sure in a piece sometime next year.
Please
so
do.
Look for it. You say, athletic departments exist solely to promote themselves. Quote, like flatworms, they have the genetic mandate to enlarge. So, and I think I think you were prescient because, you know, a couple of years ago, Ohio State's athletic department had more employees than the White House. And I'm not kidding. You can look it up. And all know, athletic director salaries now average about $500,000. For the guys who sit behind the desk and no one wants to see on TV, and they just keep expanding. We see these palatial facilities. We see, you know, what I've termed all this gold plating in college sports, and we see schools continually jumping into Division I basketball and football and spending money to get in there. They're not jumping out, so obviously it's not a bad investment for them, no matter how much they cry poor. My question to you is, looking at this and looking where it's come from 1989 to now, how much bigger can these flatworms get?
Well, I don't know what the biggest flatworm is, but I must have been really into, I liked amoebas and things like that, and, you know, studying all these things like tapeworms. I just kind of fascinated. And now with the internet, you can just look at that stuff. But flatworms, maybe they can get the size of Jabba the Hutt, you know, because one thing that happens, and you brought up Ohio State, you're limited to how many coaches you can have, but you're not limited in the front office. And if I'm not mistaken, they had something like 25 extra people in the athletic department that were mostly football-related, including things like director of player personnel, things that only existed in the pro game for a while, but now they don't. And the athletic departments at universities are far better. In general, their facilities are better than the NFL. They have bigger weight rooms. They have better indoor facilities. They have bigger offices. They have everything. You go in to see a coach, is very similar, I've got to believe, to going into seeing like a an African king, maybe about 100 years ago.
I mean, when Harbaugh was at Stanford, he had like a $60,000 office bathroom. Like, I don't know if you go back and look that. Anyone listening, go back and look that up. I mean, it's amazing, and it's it's obviously when you don't have to pay your workforce anything but like a very repressed wage. There's plenty of money to go around for everything else.
And what they'll do, Patrick, is since it grows exponentially, they're always in debt.
Right.
They're always in debt no matter what their income is because they say, my God, we've got this new wing that we're building. We haven't bought the oaken office furniture yet, and we've got three new assistants, and we haven't paid for them yet, and we've got to pay for this, and we've got to pay for that, and it never ends. You've got some of these athletic departments that are considered, like Michigan and Ohio State, and Texas, they'd almost be top 500 U.S. corporations were they valued as businesses and not as, quote, not-for-profit enterprises, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, they really are like their own independent fiefdoms, which, since we're talking about college football, is a little disconcerting because we're still supposed to be talking about academics. And I want to again bring up an amazing story from the book. It's probably something that a lot of people listening either were too young at the time or maybe have forgotten. There was a great federal trial. It involved these two agents, Norby Walters and Lloyd Bloom, who basically were in court for signing college players while they were still, quote-unquote, amateurs. And then once they signed them, they were doing stuff like threatening to break their legs if they went to other agents. So these guys weren't exactly above board. That said, their attorney took a very interesting approach in court and just basically decided to do what I would probably do if I was an attorney. He attacked the NCAA and the schools that were supposed victims because they, these players violated the terms of their scholarships by violating amateurism. So what he did is he made college officials on the stand recite the academic records of some of these star players. You recount this with withering detail. I just want to read you a couple of quick examples. There's a star Iowa defensive back who took karate, billiards, jogging, recreational leisure, which I think might be redundant. Advanced bowling and advanced slow pitch softball, because I guess regular bowling is the entry level class. And also something called introduction to military organization, which I assume that playing college football kind of already was.
Sure.
And then we had another Iowa player who took watercolor painting and received a D. And then we had this great story of, it's not great, it's kind of great in a funny way. It's an All-American running back at Temple, Paul Palmer. He flunked remedial reading four times. He didn't complete a single class in his major. He flunked or withdrew from every class his senior year, but he did pass bowling, racquetball, human sexuality, adjusting to a university, and leisure. Note, not recreational leisure, just leisure.
Yeah.
And then you quote the school's president, this guy, Peter Lyakros. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. He's the school president at the time. Basically being angry about this and saying he was going to strike Palmer's football records from the school record book because he had taken money from these agents. But as you say, he didn't mention Palmer's academic record, apparently being satisfied his young work in that area. I can't imagine that has changed at all in college football. Do you see any progress on that front?
Not much, because presidents are elected by the board, are recommended by the board and hired by the board, and the boosters control the board. Quite often the board, the regents are nothing but some of the wealthiest alums and people in the area, and they want to see the football team win. So when a president kind of goes renegade on the football program, he's likely to be fired. You're far more likely to be fired if your football team is no good than if it's great. So they are kind of slaves to the boosters and the money faction that wants to see the sports teams win. And, you know, I'll throw men's basketball in there too. But basically those two things. And we're talking about football, so it's mainly football. You'll hear the academics, the professors at the universities every now and then get all riled up and go after say this is wrong, we're not making money, they're cutting this side of the academic or the academics, this side of the school, the professors' pay, they're going down, this is wrong to have this corrupt quasi-military group out there, these football
right.
players and coaches. And I laugh at them. They're pitiful. They don't know what the real world is like, which is some guy who's a big car dealer, he'll come in and say, you know, the hell with these profs, here's a much more money. So these professors live in the, this kind of ivy tower. They think that by bleeding and writing papers, they'll get things done. No, it doesn't work that way. You got to go to the ramparts with these football guys if you really want to take them on. So I haven't seen much change in that area at all.
God, professors sound like journalists. I feel bad about myself now. It's the
yeah,
same
yeah,
thing.
That's right. Get all exercised and call another committee meeting, and write another paper that nobody's going to read.
Well, at the end of the book, and I don't want to say speaking of things that people don't read because this book was read, and I want people to go out and read it again. You do float a pretty, I wouldn't say extensively detailed, but a fairly detailed plan for reform. And actually reform might be the wrong word because I think it's more accurately characterized as a divorce. And the basic idea, you call it an age group professional football league. It'd be a little bit like junior hockey and a little bit like minor league baseball, but you would have university affiliations.
Yeah.
So basically what you call for is NFL to partially subsidize this, players who don't need to be college students, teams that use the mascots and the colors and the facilities of the university, and they can't move around from state to state or school to school like the NFL teams do or threaten to do. The players have to be 18 and 22 years old. There's a reasonable pay scale for them. And interestingly, they get one free year of tuition for every year of playing, and there's no time limit on when they can cash that in. But they do have to pass university entrance exams and requirements to go to school. Meanwhile, as this league exists, which kind of sounds like, I would call it almost like the big time age group professional football league, you propose that college football that remains that isn't part of this revert back to something almost to what it almost never was, even in the late 1800s, which is they can't charge admission. They can't use their teams to make money. Your coaching staff is limited to four people, and they have to be teachers and tenure eligible. You have only an 8-game season, no spring practice, no freshman eligibility, no athlete dorms, no scholarships, no endorsement for coaches, and everything is under university control, not these big quasi semi-independent corporate athletic department fiefdoms. I think this whole idea has a lot of sense and merit to it. Obviously, it's at least from the benefit of hindsight, seems a little pie in the sky. But let me ask you, when you look back, do you think we're any closer to reality on this? And are there any tweaks that you would make given the benefit of 20 plus years?
I think I'd make a lot of tweaks, but I think the essential premise is there. What people want, they want to root for Michigan. If they went there, they want to root for the blue and yellow. And I think that's right and that's fair. If they went to Ohio State, they want to root for Buckeyes. They want to wear Go Nuts t-shirts. But when it comes down to the game itself, it's really, if you think about it, it's just age group professionals. They are the best players in their age group. You have to go to college for 3 years before you can go to the NFL. So we're acknowledging that, if that's the way it's going to be. Then just let these guys be kind of what they already are. And they can be affiliated with the university, but if they're actually majoring in football, well, then that's okay. And if they can take limited amount of classes, well, that's okay too. But if we won't have the hypocrisy and the fraudulence of pretending that they're something that they're not. And then, if you want to play intramural sports, that's great at smaller universities. But that will appease the people from Auburn and Texas and everywhere else, and they don't have to worry about whether this guy got a free tattoo or whether he got a car from a booster, or all this nonsense that's been going on forever and ever that actually corrupts these guys, and if they're getting money down the road. And we could figure out how to do it. Agents could. I think one of my big feelings about an agent is everybody on this planet needs an agent, and your first agent is your parent. It's somebody who looks out for you and looks out for your financial welfare, and it's not wrong to have an agent. It's bad to have a corrupt one like Norby Walters, but right. the scumbags will slip in because you won't let the legitimate ones in there.
Well, that's what happens when you push an economy underground. They'll be surprised when the economy becomes a black market, and like you said, less than scrupulous people are then able to operate within it.
I mean, I think that's something that you need an education to understand. The black market always will pop up when the legitimate market is not allowed to flourish. That's how it goes.
Right.
We see that with drugs. I mean, we see it with anything.
You
see it in any country, anywhere, any economy, any market, anywhere. You can't stop these things, and if you try to pretend they don't exist, that's where you need massive amounts of enforcement and all that. Look at the NCAA rulebook. It's gargantuan. It's incomprehensible because it's trying to prop up something that's irrational.
Speaking of the crazy stat about that rulebook, by the way, this is something I just looked up the other day for something else I'm writing. 79 times it mentions the word meals. 3 times it mentions the word concussions. I think that's all you have to know about the NCAA's priorities. But I hate to interrupt. I'm sorry about that. I thought you'd appreciate that one.
I love that. Yeah, well, meals are very important, but so's brain damage.
Right. In the book, you quote a speech that was given by a university president at a 1987 NCAA special convention. He talks about a government report lamenting professionalism bringing discredit to college sports. He talks about a university president upset about sensationalism and hysteria in college sports. He talks about a National Education Association talking about the serious evils of college sports. Another educational foundation issuing a report on those evils. And another university president saying that the whole system is rife with injustice, hypocrisy, and fraud. But the kicker to this guy's speech, he says these things all occurred in 1885, 1905, 1915, 1929, and 1950. And he says, ladies and gentlemen, we've been here before. He's right. I think he's still right. And I think it's easy sometimes to look at the history of college sports, especially college football, and basically be like, you know, we've always been in some sort of perpetual hand-wringing crisis. But the sport is bigger and more popular than ever. Society doesn't really seem to share the moral outrage or the disappointment, maybe, that you express in the book and that, you know, people like myself feel when we look at the system. Do you, after 20 years after writing that, do you have any sort of sense why most people are just very content to sort of keep on keeping on?
Yeah, I do. And I realize that in the years subsequent to writing this book, which a lot of people, you know, didn't necessarily want to read. It's because we go to the world of sports for pleasure, for enjoyment, to escape what is really important in life. And we don't want to be confronted with the same issues that occur in our everyday lives. We want to have suspension of disbelief for a while. And on a beautiful fall Saturday in a stadium with 100,000 people and a goal line stand, you're looking at that and you don't want to think about anything else. And if you're watching on TV and you see these beautiful highlights and slow motion replays, you don't want to be thinking, well, you know what, this guy who just carried the ball shouldn't be at the school and isn't getting an education, and in 2 years he's going to be lucky to have a job because he'll be out of this place without a degree. You don't want to think of that, and I get that. So I think the way that these changes have to come is internally, and also make it easy on the viewers, because we're just there to watch. We're not there to reform. The reform should come from the actual people involved. We see that it's not going to. And the other thing is the players themselves have been made impotent. They have no union. They have nothing. They sign what is considered by a lot of people to be an unfair and I can't think of the exact word, but a contract that should not be upheld by law. It's an unconscionable contract, as it's called in the legal community.
But they sign away their name, image, and likeness rights for perpetuity, and that's one of the things at the core of the Ed O'Bannon case, actually. Which, you know, again, speaking of change, that's probably going to be a thing that maybe changes college sports in some ways. You know, lawyers have always been the force of change in college sports. I don't know what that says about college sports, but it seems like that's the case.
I think so. We said at the beginning, Patrick, that change will come from the legal world. It'll come from the insurance world. You know, for instance, in high school sports, if insurance companies say, we're just not going to insure you for head trauma because of these studies, we cannot. It will bankrupt or it will cause change financially. The players themselves coming in at age 18 have no rights at all, none. And if somebody says to them, you know, unionizing guys who are spread across the country or coming straight out of high school, I mean, it would be almost an impossible task, maybe not a good one. But you would think that these university officials and the NCAA guys and somebody out there would say, hey, man, this is wrong. Let's look out for the actual players. Isn't that what people are looking at? Isn't that who – they don't come to watch Urban Meyer stand on the sideline. You know, I'm not going to tune in to see Nick Saban walk around with his headset on. But I do want to see these magnificent athletes play this wonderful game, and hopefully we can reduce the risk. And if these guys are compensated for what they're doing – as you know, with these TV contracts and ESPN being behind all this, my God, that's not going to ruin anything. So it's got to come from within, and I don't see that leader. I just see a bunch of crafty guys protecting what they have, the coaches and athletic directors and NCAA officials and people like Jim Delaney making millions of dollars a year. Why would you ever share it unless you had some moral qualms about what you're doing?
No, there's, you know what, that's the one thing we've learned from history. You know, people that have power seldom give it up freely. And also in terms of your point about all of us, you know, sort of enjoying the sausage and not wanting to know how it's made, in some ways, I think an undercurrent of your book, and I don't think you say it too much directly, is being a little disappointed in all of us as spectators and fans, that we sort of enjoy the good of this, but that we don't agitate to change the bad. And that's the other lever of change that could happen, but probably won't.
Well, you know, I guess not to be too cynical, maybe awareness of the consumer, which is all of us, at least then when change is offered and it might be a little disruptive, we'll say, okay, this is the right thing to do. Let's do it. You know, something as simple, I would love to see some of these poor kids, particularly, you know, let's be frank, underprivileged black kids who came from inner city schools who didn't get the education that they should have gotten because of other flaws in our whole system. If they had annuities set up for them down the road, things that, you know, maybe it's not just here, kid, here's 10 grand on the table. But if you play in the national championship game, and that brings in, you know, $500 million, and your coach gets a $400,000 bonus, which in a lot of the cases they do, maybe you and the other team get 5% of the net or the gross or something, and it goes into some form of bond or something where you then, down the road, have a safety net for what you have produced. And when these injuries come back to haunt you down the road, you know, I'm 64. I just had finger surgery. Had to have a finger fuse, and I know exactly the moment I did it, playing when I was 20 years old on a tackle at playing in the Big Ten, and I got it caught in a guy's jersey. Well, guess who had to pay for that? My insurance company and me. But in a
of
sense,
course. Well, you were a student athlete. There's no workers' comp.
I was a student athlete. Yeehaw!
But no, I mean, I think you're right, and you know the. Probably the sort of most, to me, the most encouraging and simultaneously discouraging thing about all of it is there could be so much room for different reforms and for just trying things and trying different models and letting schools and conferences try different models. And if we could just sort of at least break out of the ossified idea that, and you know, this is one of the things that I think is bad about amateurism, but it's sort of bad by a lot of NCAA things, that one size needs to fit all. I definitely think the college football universe has moved way beyond that. And that notion is standing in the way of, like you said, trying out different things that could produce better results.
I agree completely. Absolutely. And, you know, you say teams buying in, trying to get into Division I. Well, in America, in capitalism, you will follow where the money is. You'll follow the market. And if a market is created, people are going to jump in. You know, everybody was in real estate 5 years ago, 6 years ago. Oh, my God, everybody I knew was selling real estate. Well, not so much now because there isn't quite as much money in it, and it's coming back. But that got shaken out. And so everybody's jumping into the college Division I football and basketball deals because, by God, they see the money flowing from these billion-dollar deals with these TV networks and these stadiums that seat well over 100,000 people.
Well, it's funny. It's funny, you know. And I'll get you out on this. It's funny you mention the real estate market from a few years ago and people jumping in, because I have written in Sports on Earth and in other places about what appears to be something of a sports cable bubble, and how maybe these huge amounts of TV money that we see flowing to college sports, particularly, might not always be there. But that is definitely a topic for another podcast. And I know right now we are out of time, Rick. It's been great. This is maybe my favorite podcast so far. Just so everybody out there knows, this is Rick Tellender, Chicago Sun-Times writer. The book, which is from 1989, is called The 100-Yard Lie. And I recommend all of you go out there, find a copy, read it. It will definitely open your mind. Just because it's older doesn't make it any less relevant. Until next time, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, saying goodbye. Ruby Tuesday.